3.
Chris, the topic we will be discussing today is, how do you convey the world as the GM envisions it to the players?
Hello, and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, I rolled the die today on my copy of Kids on Bikes 2nd Edition that I just got, and we were just talking beforehand. So this is a Kickstarter that I backed and then completely forgot about for like a year, as it happens, seemingly a lot in this household. But it came with, like, the cover itself has these like pre-distressed looking elements to it, like on all the corners. But it's like, you know, just part of like the visual design. And I was telling you that when I pulled it out of the package, I got really sad. So I was like, oh man, this got all beat up in transit. I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to send it back. And I waited so long for this and forgot about it and all that. But it turns out, no, it's just part of the visual design that it kind of looks like a book that has been thrown in a backpack for a while.
I think that is a smashing success then from like a design standpoint. That it made you think it was actually distressed.
I know. Yeah, it's really good. I mean, and it's like, it's so on brand. I feel like, I don't know, there's just so much like clever stuff happening in like book design lately.
Yeah.
In the TTRPG space. And I'm very much here for it. Like everything is just kind of interesting and unique. And it's like sort of not easy to pull off, but it's like, it's a lot easier than it probably used to be to do some stuff like this.
Do you have a favorite? I agree with you, by the way. Do you have a favorite book design treatment?
Oh, that's a really good one. Good question.
Here, I'll tell you
yeah,
mine.
Yeah, why don't you go? Yeah, you go ahead.
So even though I feel like we've seen a lot of this stuff in the last 5 years, the one that stands out to me is back in the 90s, White Wolf released a game called Werewolf: The Wild West,
mm-hmm.
which was like a Wild West spinoff of their werewolf game. And it had a bullet hole through the whole, it's like a big hardcover rule book. And there's just a round bullet hole going through it. And
through all the pages?
Or through the whole, yep, through both covers and all the pages in between. And I didn't own it, but I would pull it out on the bookshelf at the bookstore and just like marvel at it.
That's amazing. Do you think they actually shot it? Like, do you think someone went out? But it'd almost be easier.
I really don't know anything about book production. Is there some sort of industrial size hole puncher, basically?
Yeah. Oh,
I mean,
sure
I would
is, yeah.
I would guess they just punched it through with some sort of thing. Although I would love to imagine that they took it out and fired a shot through each copy of the book. But yeah.
You know, that, I mean, that does make me think that that would be a fun thing to sort of plan for your book design, is like some sort of very physical destruction element of it that you can't quite control, right? Like, I mean, I don't know, maybe you're a good shot and you can make the same shot 1,000 times in a row, but
this is making me, like, if I run a Wild West game, I mean, I don't even own a gun or know how I would find a gun, but it would be really fun to shoot a hole through the rule book. But I know that I would shoot through whatever the most critical chart is.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's one way to decide what rules you're going to use or not, I guess, right? It's like, yeah, like, I'm sorry, we can't use the underwater movement rules. It's just...
Okay, yeah. So over to you, though. Have you thought of something?
I'm trying to think about the like design. I think like, so there's like the format that the Blades in the Dark book is, and also this Kids on Bikes like book size.
Yeah,
I find this like format where it's like almost like a normal size book, but a mm-hmm. little bit bigger. I really like that. Really like that design, like versus the sort of like the big books that like the D&D style books. I don't even know what size that is. Probably like 8.5 by 11 or so. I'm sure there's a more official name for it, but I find those like really unwieldy. Right. So like I'm here for books that are sort of designed to be used. And I think like the Blades book is maybe not the best for that. But anything that can sort of like be designed to lay flat or sort of like, yeah, be folded over if it needs to be, like almost pamphlets and stuff like that. I really like that.
Yeah. I like Paizo publishes like quote pocket editions of their rule books, which mm-hmm. I think is a wonderful idea. They're like, they're pretty cheap and I can't use them because the font size is too small, but but it's like, yeah. All right, you bought the $60 hardcover. Like, here's the $20 version that you can just like shove in your bag.
Yes.
And reference at the table.
Yeah. There's also I cannot remember. I think there's an Instagram creator that I follow. I think their handle is Rare Materia, something like that, or Rare Material or something along those lines. But they publish a series of like one page RPGs and one page games that just look like trifold brochures. Right. Oh, so there's really gorgeous, really gorgeous, like, you know, art and design and stuff like that. But it's just like in a, like, you know, you can envision going to like a, you know, rest stop or something on a road trip and picking up a travel brochure size thing. Yeah. And I really like that sort of layout too.
The mothership like community uses that format a lot some of like the third party adventures, like a travel brochure type adventure. There's a lot of cool stuff. The other day I ordered a couple of Morkborg like community third party published things, and one of them came in like, I don't even know I don't know how to describe it, but like instead of the spine being on the side, the spine was at the top, so it was like a flip book type of thing.
Like a legal pad almost?
Yeah, like a legal pad. I was like, yeah, this is just kind of fun. Like, in this case, it's not something that like transforms my use of the product at all, but it's like, why not? It's just kind of fun.
That does feel like a very Morkborg thing. I feel like that game in particular has sort of like sucked up a lot of the like, design interest in the hobby right now.
Yes.
For good reason, right? Like that's right. That's sort of like the obvious poll that I should have gone to. Like that Morkborg book is just like, it's a masterclass in like an interesting way to lay out everything.
Yes.
For sure. Flipping through, even if you don't like the subject matter.
I'm not a design person at all, but it is interesting. I agree. Morkborg is a remarkably, you know, put together book. Like I've never handed it to someone and they weren't like, whoa, this is like, well, this is really cool. So there's a million like, you know, third party publishers out there publishing Morkborg stuff. And it's just interesting to watch people playing with the technique, but like struggling to find what made it work so well in the core book, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I have like a straight answer for that, but like there is, I mean, I think it's like, right. It's such an expression of personality. I think like, you know, but the game itself, right? Like, just the game itself is very much an expression of like the personality and like the style of play that it wants to be. But then the design of the book sort of fits into it so well too. Like you could not, I don't think you could like redo the player's handbook for fifth edition in that style and have it work nearly as well. Cause there's just like a density of information that like you don't need for Morkborg. So I don't know, like that's not a positive or negative statement that I'm making on either of those rule sets. But like, yeah, you couldn't do that game in the same way, right? Yeah. Like whereas like with Morkborg, at least my sense of it is that if you really wanted to distill all the rules down, that book could be maybe half to a third as long if, you know, if it was sort of published in a traditional manner.
Yeah, they've released like a, I think in response to people that were like, I like this game but I can't deal with this, you know, the colors and the layout. I think you can go and get just like a Word document, you know, a plain text version, and I don't remember how long it is, but it's probably like 7 pages or something.
It does not give you quite the same vibe. there's one thing I think we've talked about this before on the podcast quite a bit, the just like how game books like present information and like how different ways of presenting that information sort of work for different sorts of people. I was flipping through the Kids on Bikes book again recently, right before we got on, and I just wanted to call it that they actually have a flow chart in it. So like we've talked about flow charts before. I'm gonna hold this up for Andy.
I see it.
It's like a somewhat complicated flow chart, but this is like your general like action resolution stuff. So like the book describes it in text, like you sort of understand, like you'd think, like where you can really get into detail, but then there's also just a flow chart of like, hey, when you get down to it, this is the sort of the decision tree, right? Like this is how you have to make it. And I loved seeing that just flipping through this, because that's something that I sort of always want in books, because once I've sort of understood the overall, like the overarching idea, like behind each of these like individual elements, I really just need someone to be like, okay, here's your logic. Like, you know, step through it this way. Cause that works really well for me. And I'm sure for other people, they see them like, I am not looking at a flow chart ever.
Yes. Like, yeah. Someday I need to show you the combat flow chart for, I think the game Aftermath. It's like a super heavy, I think 1980s post-apocalyptic RPG. It has this like the world's most dense like flow chart. It's just like, when you were putting this together, did anyone think, guys, like, this is pretty unwieldy, but
so the Roll for Topicon every year, like Andy, you always do a quiz. We should hand that flow chart out to people and then have everybody flip it over at the same time. And like the first person to answer like the question of like, how much damage did you do?
Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm filing that one away.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah. So let's keep moving on, because I think we have a little bit limited time today. I need to pause for a second. I think for the first time, I have something to like pitch or to, so I'll just say it real quick. So yeah, I had a short story published in a zombie, an anthology of epistolary zombie short stories.
Okay.
Recent, and a book just came out a couple days ago, and it's called, the book is called Sincerely Departed. So you can, I think the easiest way to find it is just to go on Amazon and search for that. And it's the, it's the result that has like, you know, the gross zombie skull and eyeball on it. So, yeah.
Okay. So Andy, what is, please define epistolary for me.
It's a style of telling a story through letters or other means of communication. So like a famous example is Dracula, how most of Dracula is told through letters or journal entries. And yeah, it's a wonderful format that
I think that's great.
Yeah.
So, and then what's your, I know you wanted to do this really quickly, but I'm not going to let you. So what is your story called?
My story is called When It's Done.
Okay.
And yeah, they, so when the call for submissions went out, they said they were really hoping to see some things they hadn't seen before as far as the medium, because a lot of things jump to mind easy, you know, like easily like the email or social media posts or things like that. And those are very cool. And I'm sure there's some stories in this collection that do that and do it really well. But I'm the sort of person that reads software patch release notes.
Okay. Thank you, like, for doing so. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought it might be kind of fun if, what would a zombie apocalypse look like if it were conveyed through the patch notes of a video game? And so specifically, and also, you know, there's like a dumb joke in there. Like, if you were designing a zombie video game, what, how would you react to the zombie apocalypse?
Yeah. So that's a really, that's a good question.
Yeah. So my story is the like update notes from a development team of a zombie video game that is like adding features and tweaking their game as a zombie apocalypse plays out. So.
What, that is a heck of a hook. Okay, cool. Yeah, well, I've pre-ordered the book, and we'll drop a link in the show notes about that too. But yeah, for sure, go pick it up. And I cannot wait to bombard you with questions about like why you missed such an obvious little plot hole or whatnot.
And I'm not sure there's really more than like 1.5 pages that you could really get out of that joke.
Yeah.
So I guess, listening audience, you can, if you check it out, you can tell me if
if it
held through. But
that's great. I'm really glad you did that. You know, we've talked a lot in the past about like how much you enjoy writing and like how you like want more opportunities to do that. So like this is super cool.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So what else we got on the docket here?
Yeah. So the other thing that I wanted to bring up is, so we have both seen the movie Furiosa, the Mad Max movie. So I just wanted to call it out. We will probably have, there's one scene in particular I really want to talk about. And so we'll have, this is going to be a somewhat spoiler filled discussion of that. So if you really need to, not have spoilers about Furiosa, I guess, you know, skip ahead a little bit. I will tell you that it's not exactly a movie that hinges on a lot of like plot twists necessarily. There's, you know, the ending is phenomenal, but like, so we won't talk about that, but
the big twists are mostly like what kind of car is going to come charging into the scene next, right?
Yes. Yeah. And as a guy who is not a big fan of cars on many vectors, I was surprised at how much I was like, yeah, when certain cars showed up. Like, yeah, I was very pumped for various cars in this movie.
I've seen it twice now.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yes, because I thought it was fantastic. So, yeah, what is the scene you want to talk about?
So the scene that I want to talk about in particular is, and I don't remember a lot of the details leading up to it, but there's a scene where there is the giant semi that has been made especially for Immortan Joe.
Yes.
Who is also in the other, you know, Mad Max movie, Fury Road. It just needs to go from one place to another, from point A to point B. Like, it's got to go from the Immortan Joe's location over to Gastown to get a bunch of gas and then like come back. And so they they hire this guy who has never ever like not gotten to his location before.
Yeah.
So he's the guy that you hire. He has a name that I only saw in the credits briefly. It's like
Praetorian Jack.
Okay, yes. Praetorian Jack. All the names in this movie are phenomenal, right? Like, so like, you know, of course my GM brain is going like a billion miles a second watching this movie.
Yeah.
And then it hits the credits and then you get to see everybody's name sort of listed out. And you're just like, you have to be kidding me. Like all yes. these, every single name in here is the name of like the coolest NPC you've ever like ever thought of. Anyway, so this guy has to drive like from point A to point B. Furiosa at this point has decided she is going to stow away on the bottom of the vehicle and like make her escape as this is going on. So like they're going and of course they are attacked by a gang, right? Like, you know, as they're going. And it is like, it's one of those things where like, if you're thinking about like it in RPG terms, which of course I was, the thought of like, how do you make this interesting just like popped into my mind almost immediately. It's like,
yeah.
Everything about it, like they're just showing you, it's a straight road. Yeah, it's just a straight road. Like it's going to take them hours to go down this like highway stuff. And it's like, how do you make this like attack interesting? Because like really, it's just sort of like, what? It's like a big semi going forward. Right.
Yeah. Right.
And of course, like the, you know, George Miller is brilliant at this. Like he manages, there's all sorts of ways it's interesting. And I think like you and I were talking, the control that Miller keeps over the action is just genuinely amazing, because I think like in yes. a lot of movies this would be impossible to follow, right? Or yeah. just like totally like it wouldn't be very interesting. There'd be sort of like one car tries to run it off the road and then that's it, right?
Yeah.
Like, but there, it's an extended sequence. I mean, I don't know, like it felt like maybe 15 yeah, 20 minutes.
It's a yeah. good 10-15 minute action
yeah.
sequence.
Yeah, like this action sequence, and there's all sorts of stuff happening, and you never at any point feel like you don't know what's going on.
Yes.
Like it's all very clear. There's a lot of like good establishing shots and stuff yep. and stuff in it. But then on top of that, right? So there's like the action's very clear, whatever, like all that stuff's good. Like the fundamentals are there. But then just the number of cool things that happen in that 10-minute sequence is just like, that could be in a whole movie by itself.
Yeah.
Right. Like you have like, yeah, there's various fights that are happening on board. Furiosa goes from hiding underneath the semi to like, you know, going above, fixing it, like doing all this other stuff. There's all sorts of like interpersonal conflict that's happening. At one point towards the end of it, like it's revealed that Furiosa is a woman, and this is the first time that like that people on the semi have noticed that she's a woman and everything. It's just like there's just such a density of like information and action in that scene. And I just wanted to talk about it because, like, I just was like vibrating with excitement
yeah.
every time it was done. Yeah. So I don't know. Like, so I've talked a little bit about that, and sounds like yeah. you also like that scene.
I'll just follow up on that. I agree with you. I think it was a genius level action sequence,
yeah.
and I would say that slightly to a lesser degree, but there's another action sequence with the same war rig a little mm-hmm. later in the movie that I think is also
yes.
genius for many of the same reasons, but. In that first scene, like, so you're right. And like, what's kind of interesting is the characters in the scene do plenty of like shooting at each other with mm-hmm. their guns, like the RPG equivalent of just, you know, I roll to attack.
Yeah.
But they do a lot. They're doing a lot of stuff that is not directly making an attack roll.
Mm-hmm.
And things that happen create complications that Furiosa has to solve before she can just pull out a gun and shoot him.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Someone plants a stick of dynamite to the base of the rig.
Mm-hmm.
So Furious has to deal with that. One of the attacks damaged, one of the engines is leaking. So mm-hmm. so she's got to crawl down there and fix that up. And mm-hmm. The radiator cap blew off and it landed in like some fire and it's like
yeah.
super hot. And someone's got, you know, and I'm not even touching on like kind of the tactical complications that come out of the action sequence takes place over a couple of waves, and basically each wave introduces kind of a new kind of bad guy with mm-hmm. a new special ability.
Yeah.
And I really don't like, it's just delightful to see. So I really am not going to say what those are, but
yeah.
each new wave does something different that is not, they have a bigger gun.
Yes.
It yeah. introduces like a tactical complication
mm-hmm.
that requires Furiosa and the others to like shift how they're dealing with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution for fighting off wave one is different than the solution for fighting off wave two is different than the solution for wave three. And
yeah.
there's a lot in there. I think there's a lot in there that could be pulled into your next big set piece.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And like none of the, like, I mean, you mentioned like waves. It never feels like it's like, oh, like, okay, so you've knocked down all the, you know, tier one goons. Now we're bringing in the tier two goons or something like that. Like, it's like each of them, sort of the gang itself that's doing the attacking, it feels like this is like, oh, these are just sort of like all the different ways that they've figured out how to do this sort of ambush.
Yes.
Right. Like this, like, you know, train car ambush or whatever. They're trying to deploy all their their tricks, and like it's just not working because they keep on getting stymied. By this war rig. Like, I did want to call out the dynamite scene, like the dynamite sequence in particular, because like I think like this is also an example of like, I mean, you think about like, why do we play role-playing games and stuff like that? Like, I think it's for me, the answer is often to be surprised in some way, both with the things that you come up with and the things that your players come up with, and like just sort of like what gets generated at the table. When that stick of dynamite, it gets kind of placed underneath the war rig, and Furiosa is faced with like, well, I need to do something about that, or the whole thing blows up and I die and everybody dies and stuff like that. So she crawls over there and she does the thing that I did not think she would do, which is pull it off and throw it back at them. Right.
I expected that too.
Everybody's just like, yeah, that's your kind of your expectation is like, oh, I can see this thing, I'm going to take it and just throw it back at them. Like, you know, that you can't do that. Instead, she snips off the wick to stop it from going, and then now she has like this new item, right? Yes. She has this new this new item that she can then use later on, you know, for something else. And it's just like, it's one of those things where I think Miller also knew, like Miller and his team knew that's what you were expecting her to do in that scene. And like, it's just, it really subverts sort of your expectation in just like, such a delightful way, because like I found myself like gasping when she did that. It's like, oh, of course, why wouldn't you do that?
And then when it pays off later, you know, it's an option she has, and when an opportunity comes up later for that to pay off, it like, it's really fun to see it pay off.
Yeah, it's really fun to see it. Yeah. And it just, I don't know. So it sort of makes me, like you mentioned complications, like it does make me think a lot about like the complications that we give our players at the table, and like having a variety of things happening and then just sort of like, well, you got to deal with it, right? Like sort of figure out how to deal with it. It's like that is so fun. Cause like, you could definitely shoot that sequence in a way where there's nothing really surprising about it, but everything kind of blows up, and like, that's super cool. Right. But yeah, then there's also this way to do it, which I'm sure took much more effort on their part, but like also, like you mentioned, will kind of go down as like one of the action sequences to like, to look at and study or to just enjoy if you're thinking about action sequences.
There's one other thing I wanted to mention about the film as a whole that got my GM brain turning. And we talk a lot about tone, about like the tone setting, establishing a tone for your game at the table. And, you know, we've talked about that endlessly, but Furiosa is a good example of a movie that nails like the tone it wants.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is a profoundly cartoonish, silly world. Like, it's very, very silly. If you were to ask literally any question of, like, how do they fill in the blank? It makes no sense, right?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, their economy is, like, trading bullets for cabbage. I mean, like, you know, that's the... it's all very silly. And yet, the story is very serious. The movie knows it's silly, and so it's not sitting there glowering at you, reminding you that this is serious business. You know, it knows how silly it is, but the story has real emotional weight to it. And that's a really tough balance. Like, you know, the temptation to make it a little sillier must have been there, right? And then you get, and then you're moving into like Guardians of the Galaxy quips and things like that. And I mean, the temptation to make it, you know, deadly serious was probably also there. And so this threaded that needle somehow. And I don't really know exactly how it did that. So that's not very useful GMing advice. But I guess I would say this movie took a silly premise as seriously as it needed to tell a story that like was meaningful to the audience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, because like I think all the individual characters sort of taken on their own are deeply silly, but the circumstances are not, right? Like in a way. Yeah, like I'm just thinking about like there's like all the like the sort of the leaders of each of these factions and stuff, like they're just cartoonish villains. Like that's what it comes down to. Like totally cartoonish villains, but since we're following Furiosa, someone who doesn't have a lot of power for lots of reasons in like, you know, in the setup for this, like you can feel the threats coming from every direction. So even when something very slapsticky happens, right, like there's this underlying threat to it. Like, you know, there's many people like kind of fall off tall things to their to their death, right? And like if they had fallen off and sort of like bonked their head, it'd be like, oh, that's, you know, like that's funny, right? Like that's funny if it happens in a cartoon, but like, oh, like you fell like 200 feet into like into an explosion,
right?
Like you're not walking away from that. It's like there's this element of slapstick, but like you don't get like the payoff of slapstick. Like
interesting. Yeah.
I think it's sort of like I feel like John Wick is similar. Like I think action movies these days are playing around with that maybe a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Like you can look at like, okay, this is gonna, I'm gonna make a couple connections here. Like Jackie Chan is very much like slapstick, like, right, like a lot of those action sequences in his movies are slapsticky like that. John Wick, like, I think employs a lot of the similar movements and stuff, but like it, every time he takes an action, someone's life is taken taken in some way, right? Like, so it, you almost, you have this like sense of like, oh, that's really funny but also like really grim at the same time. Yeah, so anyway, Furiosa I think also kind of treads that line. Things that are sort of coded slapsticky almost, but like have this like this deep sorrow and fear and like tragedy and stuff to them.
How much worse would this movie have been if it had felt the need to like explain and justify this stuff?
Yeah.
Like it's I mean, this movie is like kind of entering in agreement with you that it's going to show you like what you need to know and know more. Mm-hmm. And you're going to, I contrast this with, so think about when Star Wars first came out and there's like all this crazy, silly alien stuff all over the place. And I think how much magic is lost now that you and I can both name like every alien in the cantina, in the Mos Eisley cantina, and probably give a bit of his backstory and stuff like that. You know, the purpose of those being there was like to create this tone and atmosphere. They're not there to be like questioned or examined or detailed out. And I'm sure there is a Mad Max wiki out there that has you know this stuff. Yes, but yeah. You know, this is a movie that wants you to take it seriously but doesn't want you to take it that seriously.
Yeah, like, you, what is it, Poe Nudo is one of the like cantina,
it could well be,
right? Yes. Like, you know, it's like, yeah, like you don't need to know anything more about like Admiral Akbar, right? Like,
right.
Like, it's kind of the less you know is better. And I feel like, yeah, like with the Mad Max Fury Road, there's a character in that. This is the like the Doof Warrior, like named as the Doof Warrior.
Oh yes, the guitar guy.
Yeah, guitar guy, right? Like guitars, flames, and stuff, providing a similar sort of like idea as like the like trumpeteers or whatever in like in old style armies and stuff, like going forward and like, yeah, getting people hyped up. It's like, you don't need to know anything else about this guy. Like,
yeah. Right. Yeah.
Like, you don't want to, like, yes. Those details are just like, so like, it just makes the world so rich. Right. And like, but like having a backstory to that guy other than like, he likes guitar, it's just like, I don't know.
It somehow hurts the richness of the world, right?
Yeah, and I don't know why that is. I think it's just, like, you kind of want it to be, it's just this cool thing that exists, but you don't want to have to think about, like, I don't know, like, did he have to, like, buy new strings recently? Like, you know.
Or, right.
You know, like, how did he learn how to play guitar? Like, why is there still a guitar around when, like, you know, you're fighting for, like, any scrap of, like, what? Like, it's just all this stuff, and it's, but, like, I think there's also an element of, like, but then, I don't know, like, music is still going to be important even in the apocalypse and stuff like that. Like, you know, so like there's reasons why you can understand this character exists. It's not just something that's like invented out of nothingness and has no bearing or like weight or interest or anything like that in the world. However, you also don't really want to know anything else about it.
Yeah, totally.
Like, it really detracts from it in some way. So like, I don't know how you take that to the table, because I think like if you put the Doof Warrior in your D&D game, your players are going to have nothing but questions about the Doof Warrior.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Or, you know, any of the sort of like the named, but like, you know, quickly departed goons in like in Furiosa and stuff. But it's just like, yeah, but like all those things are just so tantalizing too. Like, you want to know more and you don't want to know more. And like, mm-hmm. Yeah, the knowing exhausts the interest. And like, yeah, I don't know. So,
yeah, it's good. Absolutely. Stuff. Is this we can move on, but I just need to check, is this your way of easing us into your 75-page backstory of the Dufourier.
Yes.
Starting with his tragic past.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
He was raised by a guitar.
See, that sounds about right for this setting.
You know,
somehow.
Honestly, yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, yeah, like his only parents were his guitar and the fire that kept him warm at night.
Right. Okay, so hey, should we move on to our topic here?
Yeah, let's do that. Otherwise, I'll keep talking about Furiosa.
Let me just reread that. So, the question is, how do you convey the world as envisioned by the GM to the players?
Okay, so this actually does fit pretty well, I think, to what we were just talking about.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about this. I don't remember where this question came from. So how do you read this question?
I don't know. I think we probably added this one a while ago. I guess I sort of think about this question in terms of, like, you as the GM probably have more answers to, like, what the world is than the players are asking necessarily. So there is a tendency to sort of stop every once in a while and be like, okay, here's a bunch of new information for you, right? Like this is all the information that you need to know. But like that ends up not being super fun, I think, to players. Just because it's like, you know, it's not very like action oriented if you're just having to learn like a bunch of history about something or whatever. Imagine if Miller was running a Furiosa RPG or something like that. Like, you know, like he wouldn't start with like he doesn't start those like his movies, and he wouldn't start those movies with like a giant lore dump of like, yeah, here's the 300 pages of backstory, right?
That right.
You need to know to get at this. So like when I'm thinking about this question, that's really sort of what I'm focused on is like, okay, like if you know, like, I don't know, we were talking in the Discord about like, you know, like what's the local fruit variety, right? Like, I think you had mentioned this, like in your world, like what's the fruit that everybody eats, right? Like, is there a way to convey that to the players that isn't just like oh, and by the way, you need to know that also there's this fruit that everybody eats. Like, you know, like what are the ways that you would convey that to your players outside of just like, yeah, the like block text lore dump.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's a tricky one. The traditional approach is here's the setting Bible, you know, if you want to play in the Forgotten Realms, read this book that explains everything you need to know about the Forgotten Realms or whatever. Right. In my kind of like ideal scenario is the GM knows most of this stuff or has the info he or she needs to come up with it on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And they present it when the players ask a question or interact with that piece of the setting. So when the player asks, like, what is there to eat in this town? Then you bust out, well, that the local fruit is this and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But you don't describe that to the players, like, until they really ask to engage with it.
Yeah.
I mean, unless, I guess, it's, like, crucially important that they know that this is Fruit Town, right?
Yeah. Do you, okay, so, like, let's maybe dig into that a little bit, right? So I think there's, okay, so in the fruit example, right, like, you could, I think there's, you know, like, one end of the spectrum is, hey, like, what you need to know about Fruit Town is, like, this fruit is really important to them, like, right, like, so you just sort of state that up front. I think the other end of the spectrum is, like, never telling them the name of the thing until they, like, ask an NPC in, you know, in character.
Yeah.
Like, so I think there's like a lot of sort of different ways to like to approach that. So like what you were mentioning, you know, like if someone says like, hey, what's there to eat in this town? You could tell them at that point, or you could say like, oh, well, there are these restaurants or like these markets you can go to, or like, I don't know, like, or you could say like, you can't ask me, you need to go and ask an NPC, you know, NPC that, I guess, yeah. What do you tend to do then? So it sounds like you might like, you know, wait for them to ask generally. And then you might say sort of like out of character as the GM sort of delivering information. Would you ever try to do that like in the voice of an NPC or like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more likely to deliver that information in the voice of the GM. Okay, now you've asked about the fruit. So like, here's what you need to know about the fruit here.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. I don't know. I'm thinking like have you ever played a video game, like especially like an RPG? Like, so I'm playing through Starfield and it does this a lot. And like, if there's a piece of information the players need to know, like, it'll be the only thing that like every NPC, it'll come up in every conversation, you know, like, so if the player needs to know that tomorrow is like the world's fair every NPC will like what this will come up. And
yeah,
I kind of laugh at, I mean, I, there's reasons that that is the case in a video game, but I kind of laugh at that. All that to say, no, I mean, just that my personal way I GM, I'm more likely to be like, to not try and make that come naturally through the voice of a person in the setting, unless it's a real easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, like, so I'm replaying Secret of Evermore. It's a Super Nintendo
role-playing
game right now. It's really good, but I mean, it's the exact same thing, right? Like, you, right? Like, every sort of next thing you need to do is definitely being conveyed by everybody you talk to. Or they say, like, oh, you should go ask, you know, go ask our village leader. Like, you know,
right.
Yeah, what's going on? Right, and I think there's some cause for that in like a tabletop game, right? Like, where you might, you know, you might have that sort of start happening, especially if there's like a plot point that people are really missing. I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that, because if it is an important thing in your world, most likely everybody's going to be talking about it. Like, yeah, if there's a giant fair happening in the town, probably everybody's going to be aware of it. Maybe they're complaining about it, right? Like, think about like where I live in Ann Arbor, we have a, like, you know, there's an art fair every summer. And when it gets around that time, every conversation is like, are you going? Are you not going? How annoying is it going to be to drive around there? Right. Like, you know, like, oh, your partner was almost like a vendor. you're just like, you talk about it. Right. Like, so I think it's okay for that stuff to sort of come up in conversations. With everybody that they're talking to. But I think I'm trying to think, like, as a player, like, what's the interesting way? Like, what are the interesting ways to get that information, right? I think, like, there is, I think for me, like, as a player, sometimes, like, I don't want to be told, like, yeah, I don't want the lore dump. I think I like the stumbling on feeling that can come with, like, oh, like, we asked about what there's to eat, and, like, oh, there was an answer to that. Like, there's a really cool thing that we didn't know about that's important. So I think, like, you know, if you're thinking about, like, how to convey the world and, like, why you should do it this way, I think there's just a certain amount of delight, I think, I think the player is feeling like they are clever because they asked about something and got a good answer that has something to do with, like, the world and the story that they're in.
There is a struggle in settings that are pretty history heavy to convey that history without requiring the players to just read something or have somebody tell them a tedious, big, long chunk of block text. You know, read aloud text. And you were asking, like, when does this become interesting to the players? And I think if you think about the pieces of the setting that the players interact with, so the players will interact with the weapons of the setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they will wield them, they will own them, they will shop for them. What can you add to the weapons of the setting that is reflective of the setting and like that expresses some of the uniqueness of the setting? So whatever, maybe every sword is every sword has like two notches in it to honor, you know, Grogar notch sword, you know.
Of course, yes.
And then, you know, no one has to read a paragraph about that, but it makes the setting feel a little bit more interesting and unique, I think. And it lets you sneak a little bit more of your setting into, in a way that doesn't detract from anything. It's just one extra sentence in describing the sword, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, so like if you're in Fruit Town, and like if Fruit Town has a special fruit and everybody worships Grogar, the two notch god, something right. like that, like, right, like I think delivering that information as like, okay, you're approaching Fruit Town, and like, right, like it's like this, here's the deities, here's the local like flavor and all that, as like someone in the setting, right, like if you're playing as the player, like you're the character, like you wouldn't just get that info dump from anybody. That's not how information would be delivered to you at all. And I think like that's not really how information is necessarily delivered to people, like, you know, like if you're just walking around in the real world, like, so you would pick up things that way. Like that's how you would, like, that is much more interesting to do. And like very, again, tantalizing. I think we've used that word before on this, but like, yeah, like to see like, oh, like all the swords have two notches in them. Like why do they have that?
The language of your setting is a pretty significant way to do this. You know, think about in English, the way that we routinely attach the suffix gate to things to mean scandal. So, yeah. You know, whatever gate. Why do we do that? It's because 60 years ago, we had this epic scandal, Watergate.
Yeah.
And it was such a big deal that it like introduced new things into our vocabulary that people use today without even people who couldn't tell you what Watergate was about will talk about whatever gate on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
As a GM, you cannot exhaustively come up with, like, you know, a whole vocabulary of your setting.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take too many of those little things to throw in and provide some flavor, you know?
Yeah.
I think really about the Planescape setting in D&D uses Victorian slang.
Yeah.
So really doesn't really have any much effect on the game, you know, except that people will call you a Burke instead of a, you know, because that's what you called if you were a street urchin or whatever in London in 1850. But that little bit of work, Planescape going, yeah, here's like five Victorian words that are used instead of modern English words.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a really small thing. It's like, that's like 40% of the flavor of the whole Planescape setting came out of that.
Yeah, it's a super good point. Yeah, I think about the game that we played once, Dialect, I think that was the name of it. Like, right, we were sort of inventing language too. Like, I mean, you know, all told, we came up with maybe 5 to 10 new words or so, but like that is enough to sort of like provide a lot of lore and setting and stuff too. Yeah, so that's a really good point. I mean, I like that. I mean, you can even think about, like, I don't know, like Battlestar Galactica has a few things like that too. Like, you know, again, think about other media. Like, yeah, there's just a handful of phrases and derogatory slurs and things like that, that, like, yeah, just really, like, I don't know, give you something to reach for when you're not quite sure, like, how do I make this place feel like it's a different place than the last one they were at? Like, yeah, by all means, yeah, lean into that a bit.
D&D comes with such a strong pre-established set of, like, assumptions about the world and the types of setting you'll be in.
Mm-hmm.
In like the 90s, I want to say, as people were really branching out from D&D, you started getting these really, really wild settings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I want to say, like, Talislanta and Tekumel and others. And, like, these are really neat settings on paper, but, like, they're, everything about them is unique and weird. And it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
Planescape's small tweak to vocabulary is more effective than trying to teach players about every language in this setting follows these weird, you know, is better than trying to, like, overhaul and overdo, like, the uniqueness. So, like, you know, you really just need, like, one interesting piece of the town that connects it to your setting or something. Like, it's Fruit Town. This is their special fruit. Like, that's all you need. It doesn't also need to have, like, to tie into a million other things of your setting, right?
Yeah, it's it's good stuff. We need to wrap up, but I mean, I'm just thinking about, like, how, like, Fruit Town to me already feels really real, like, as a place, even though we just have a few things about it. And, like, it also seems a little silly, like, why would you name something Fruit Town? But then I think about, like, I don't know, like, in Furiosa there's a place called, like, Gas Town, right? At the same time, like, that's ridiculous. But then I think about, like, I used to live nearby a city in Indiana called Gas City. It's like, you know, this is just how we name things, right? Yes. Like, why wouldn't you call the town that develops this fruit that, like, is really good, like, why wouldn't you call it Fruit Town?
There is a fruit port, like, 30 minutes down the road from me. I think it is what it sounds like.
I know. And, like, what, you live in Grand Rapids, like, there are Grand Rapids, like, okay, all right, well, let's wrap it up there. I think this is a good conversation. I apologize to those who did not want to hear about Furiosa for 20 or 30 minutes, but that's what you got right now.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, well, we have been Roll for Topic. We're part of Roll for It Media, the Roll for It Media podcasting network. Our sister show, The Splat Book, with John Corey and Kyle Latino, is wonderful. You can find them at thesplatbook.com. I have not listened to their latest episode, but they had Evan Torner on, and I believe Matt Wilson as a guest, to talk about some, like, D&D history, which I'm looking forward to listening to. I love Splatbook. I also really love the times where the show kind of gets hijacked by guests to talk about, like, other history related stuff. There's just so many, like, interesting, fascinating, smart people in the community that get to go on there every once in a while, just sort of go off on their thing. So it's good. Yeah, go find them and listen to them. They are wonderful.
I just played in a game of Kyle's project, Starborg.
Oh yeah, how'd that go?
It was a total blast. Okay. And I think that will be getting released sometime in the next.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, that's really good. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that does it for us. I have been Chris Salzman.
I have been Andy Rao.
And remember, if your players are having fun, you're a great GM.